Let me encourage you to take advantage of the announcement that Tim made concerning the Bible memorization. The participation in that project this session has been far greater than in the previous year. I think already I have five of you that have quoted the passage in comparison to one the year before, so that's a marked improvement, and now we have time for more of you to make that list. Some of you have been asking me the last couple of weeks as to how much time would be extended, and you were giving up because you thought that the time was already passed. So anybody can learn anything in a month, I suppose. I have, if you have difficulty finding me, and some of you I think have been intimidated for some reason from speaking it to me. I can't imagine that. I don't know it, so don't be intimidated. But I have designated my wife as an official listener as well, so if you would rather quote it to her, she will serve there in my stead. That's good. All right, Ecclesiastes. Our summer project, the message of Ecclesiastes, and if we can correct some of the notions and misunderstandings about this book that have surrounded it for our many years, I trust it will be a profitable summer for us. Now, we have argued that Ecclesiastes is giving us God's divinely inspired philosophy of life. God is concerned that we as His people who have been purchased, redeemed by the blood of His Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, to have that intimate association and relationship with Him, ought to live life in this world in a way that is acceptable unto Him, a way that brings pleasure to Him, and a way in which we also are content and satisfied and truly happy in life. The theme of Ecclesiastes, I suppose, could be boiled down in the concept of true happiness. Happiness not in that mundane sense of always being grinning. There are going to be times in life where it's impossible to grin, impossible to laugh or to smile. But nonetheless, with that relationship that we have with God, we can, in this world, in this life, under the sun, enjoy true contentment, satisfaction, happiness, if you will, in life. I reduced the formula for happiness in Koheleth to this little equation. True happiness, we're learning, is to enjoy the present plus looking to the future or eternity. We cannot be creatures of time, for we are under the sun. Life is vain. Life is a breath. And so, therefore, we cannot live just for this life. Becomes a very foolish thing indeed, and that is the way the ungodly are living. All they have to look forward to is this life. And therefore, when all the trials and difficulties and uncertainties in life are experienced, there's nothing but frustration and despair that results. So we are not just to live for life, but we are to enjoy the present. We are to realize, as we've learned week by week, that everything in life is God's gift to us. God is concerned that we enjoy and that we take full advantage of all the benefits that He has given to us in life. So we enjoy the present, but we temper that with looking to the future, with looking to eternity. God has set eternity in our hearts. We are not temporal creatures. We are looking forward then to that which can really and truly satisfy, and that is eternal. And, of course, then is that which drives us to our relationship with God. So the book of Ecclesiastes, I think, can be in many ways reduced to that little equation. If we are to enjoy life, if we are to know true happiness in this life that God has given to us, well, we're going to enjoy the present, take advantage of what God has given, but always looking to eternity, always remembering that we have a relationship with God. And it's only that that can satisfy, and we are accountable to God because of that. We'll develop that in the next theme that we consider. All right, now, We've seen that particular concept developed over and over again in the book. During these last few sessions, we've been taking some of the themes that occur in Ecclesiastes and developing these with that tension of potential versus limitation. There are potentials that life has. All these gifts that God has given to us possess potentials that we are to use, take advantage of, but we are to temper those with the realization of the limitations. And that balance, the limitations that exist with our labor, with our life, with our pleasure, with whatever, are the constant reminders to us that this life is not all there is. We are not to be satisfied with just the temporary, with just the temporal. We are eternal creatures. And so we're constantly faced with the realization that everything in life has its limits, its limitations. And that reminder is what drives us to find our complete, ultimate satisfaction and contentment in God Himself. Now, we started last week looking at the theme of labor, the theme of our labor, our work that God has given us to do in this life. And we spent some time last week particularly looking at the potentials that exist in our labor, remembering that it's the gift of God, our occupations, the work that God has given us. And it may be varied. As I look across this group of people here, there are varied occupations that I see, and that's well, and that's good, and that's according to the purpose of God. God has not made us all the same thing. It would be a grieving thing, I suppose, if God made everybody in the world Hebrew teachers. Who would we teach? We'd all be trying to teach each other, and that never works. God's not made us all the same. We all have different inclinations, different desires, different interests. But all of that's God's gift to us. We have different abilities. And we have to recognize that our station in life is according to God's providential government, according to God's providential wisdom, and we are what we are by the grace of God and by the purpose of God. So we must be willing then and eager to develop the potentials that God has given to us. If we could summarize what God has done for us in our labor. Why does this thing never fit here? God has given us various resources to conduct our labor with various purposes. He gives us abilities. He gives us the wherewithal to do the work that He has ordained that we do for His glory. He's given us certain faculties to think, to reason through, to have ideas in the area in which He's placed us. And He's given us the knowledge to apply to life. That's what it says there, the L-I. I have an F-E on my paper there. To apply all of this to life. There's the wisdom, that practical skill and ability to work out our labors for the good that God has for us in life. Now, all of those potentials, and we recognize those, and we ought to learn to rejoice in those potentials that God has given to us, regardless of what it is. I think, again, as we've hinted at on numerous occasions, it's very easy for the people of God to look at their station in life and become somewhat discouraged as they try to determine what is this going to do for eternity. How is being a housewife or an accountant or a lawyer or a Hebrew teacher, for all that goes, how is that making any lasting contribution to eternity? And we have a desire to serve God, and we have a desire to make eternal values and to make eternal contributions in our labor. And we see what we do, and we can become somewhat discouraged. We remember that what we are is God's gift. God has not called everyone to be a missionary. Some that God has called don't obey. That's certainly true. But God does not call all to be missionaries. He does not call all to be ministers. Those that have that call ought to rejoice in the highness and the greatness of that call and respond with eagerness to fulfill the call that God has given. But not everybody is so called. Does God have a purpose? Does God have a will for those that aren't called to the mission field? Does God have an interest and a concern for those that do not fulfill the pulpit? Well, sure He does. Sure He does. And we must realize that if we are obedient to what God has given us to do, if we have submitted to His will and we are responding with clear conscience as to the call of God, well, we can rest assured that God is just as concerned and interested in what we do as what Mr. Kearns does or what Mr. Whoever on the mission field does. God is concerned and interested and purposeful with every one of His children. And we ought then to rejoice in that and not feel frustrated in the labor that God has given us to do. We are to enjoy it. That's the theme that we addressed last week. We are to enjoy the labor that God has given us to do, to look forward to it, to find contentment in it, to find fulfillment in that labor. And again, it does not matter what that labor is. Some of you thought last week that I exaggerated when I said I look forward to Mondays. Well, it's true. I like what I do. I like what I do, and I can't see myself doing anything else right now. God may change that. I don't know. But right now, I flat out enjoy what I do. And I take that as evidence of God's purpose and God's desire fulfilled in the occupation that He has given me to do. Some of you look at what I do and you say, I don't know how that guy sticks it. Why does he? Well, you know, that's fine. I look at what some of you do and I say, I don't know how you could stick what you do. Well, you know, God has given us each one different abilities, different interests, and we are to rejoice, I say, in the station that God has given us in life. All right, now today I want to look at some of the limitations to labor. While labor is God's gift to us, while we are to enjoy it, take full advantage of it, there are nonetheless certain limitations that are associated with our labor as well. It's vanity, just like everything else in life. Look at chapter 1 and verse 14. I have seen all the works, or I have seen all the labors. I have seen all the labors that are done under the sun. And behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. All the labor that is done in this sphere of life under the sun is breath. It's transient. It's temporary. All labor, not excluding any here, but the performance of all labor, even that of ministers, of missionaries, of Hebrew teachers, is limited in its scope and performance to under the sun. It's temporary. It's transient. All labor falls in that category. A striving after wind, vexation of spirit. You remember what that meant? A striving, a chasing after wind. There are going to be those elements that are unsubstantial. But the unsubstantial aspect of that labor does not negate its importance or its worth. Chapter 2, verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit. And there was no profit under the sun. Verse 17, therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Oh, what a pessimistic statement. I hated life. Well, let's remember, I think we've talked about this before, these terms hate and love in the Scripture do not always have the emotional connotation that they tend to have in our English usage. Koheleth, Solomon here, the preacher, is not saying, I abhorred life. He's not saying that I had this aversion to life and it was nothing but a miserable experience for me. No, it's not what he's saying. Remember, and I think I say we've talked about this before, hating and loving in the Old Testament, and I can say this for the New Testament Scriptures, the words there as well, are not primarily emotional-oriented words. The words to love and to hate in the Scripture are primarily what? Do we remember this? Here's love. I got green for some reason there. And hate. You can never see this. Where do you have to go to put that thing on the screen? That's why I'm a Hebrew teacher. I couldn't figure that out. Love and hate, not primarily emotional words, but they are what? We have talked about this, I remember. Words that involve the will. People with me? Yeah. Will. They are willful, volitional terms. We have those expressions, Jacob I love. God says, Jacob I loved, and Esau I hated. Well, that has been a source of difficulty for some interpreters. How can God have this aversion, this abhorrence to poor Esau? Well, it's not talking about God's emotional feelings toward Esau. It's talking about God's will. God determined to set His will, to incline His will, and everything that that involved upon Jacob. And He refused to do that in regard to Esau. Loving and hating become words, particularly love, in the doctrine of salvation in the Word of God. This becomes a term of election. The term to love in the Scripture is a word that is associated clearly and closely with the doctrine of God's electing grace. He loves. He chooses to set His affection. Yes, affection is involved there. But the inclination of His will. And the same thing is true when we love God. I've dealt with folks who think of their love for God. And they wonder, you know, am I loving God? What does it mean to love God? And they're trying to work up this some emotional experience within their breast. You know, do I have the same feeling for God that I love that I have for my wife? You know, I can look at my wife. There's the affection there, and there's that emotion, and you know. Is that what it means to love God? And I don't have that affection, and my emotions are... Well, let's put the word in its proper perspective. Yes, there is going to be an affection that we have for God. But loving God is not just having some emotional fervor boiling up in our gut. That's not what loving God is. It's an act of the will. To love God is to incline my will toward God. To love God is now to be bent in the direction of God. My desires are to be fulfilled in God. Oh, I may not always have this sense of emotional... What? Excitement or whatever. What? Exuberance. Yes. Can I make a confession here to you? I've been married now. You may not believe this. Sandra, how long? What? 16 years. I don't look that old. I got married when I was, what, 13? What? Something like that. I've been with this woman here. Used to call her a girl. Now I call her a woman. For 16 years. And I'm not particularly a romantic, but I am not embarrassed to tell you people that I love her. I love her. But I will confess to you this, that in the 16 years that I have been married to this woman, there has not always been that emotional, what was your word, exuberance. All right? I have never stopped loving her. But there is not always, even in the husband-wife relationship, or is this, do we have a problem here, Sandra, I wonder? There's not always that emotional, and where the heart is palpitating, you know, Charlene knows what I'm talking about here. she's experiencing that part of it. Well, that never goes, but it's not, as we would in the Greek, it's not in the present tense. It's not always continuous. You know, thank the Lord it comes back every once in a while. But, all right, but you understand what I'm saying? She's the object of my concerns. And my will is directed toward her. And even when we have that occasional spout and row, I still love her. I still love her. I'm still concerned, and she's the object of my willful inclination. Now, we have to understand that. So when you think of your love for God, it's not just to be, you know, how am I emotionally fervent here? Am I able to weep? Or, you know, that may be at times part of it. But to love God is to be consciously and willfully choosing God. My will, my desires, my affections, my inclinations are directed toward God. He is the object of all of those things. And even if I am not in still, as I make decisions, it's with the interests, if you will, of that relationship that I have with God in view. These are words of the will. All right, now I'm saying all of that so we can understand what Kohelis says here in verse 17. I hated life. I hated life. He's not throwing his hands up in despair here and saying, oh, there's so much discouragement in life and this, that, and the other that there's no use. There's no use. I hate it. I'm really eager to die. No. Yeah. Yeah, I think we're going to conclude here that he is rejecting life as an end in itself. Okay? He's rejecting life as an end in itself. And I think this is where the whole book is taking us. I reject life. What is the world? The world lives for this life. They have nothing to look forward to. They refuse to look forward to that eternity. All they desire, all they are, it's life. Let's get the most and let's, you know, it's me and who cares what else. But that's not the philosophy. That's not the perspective for life that a believer ought to have. We take advantage. We use, but we reject life as an end in itself. Our labor is not an end in itself. It's a means to an end. It's that which takes place within this sphere. But let's look at the limitations. If all I look is at the advantage, if I look just at the advantages that my labor has, and the joy and this and that and whatever, and the wealth perhaps that it brings into the home, and we, you know, it's very easy to let that be the motivating thing in life. That I'm going to live now for my work. I'm going to live for my labor. And I'm going to go into the office and I'm going to stay there and I'm never going to come home because Well, our labor has a purpose. But let's remember that it's temporary. Our labor is temporary. And so there are reasons then that we are to reject finding our ultimate fulfillment in the things that are associated with time. We are not to find our ultimate satisfaction in things that are associated with time. So that's the idea of hating life. You understand what I'm saying here? If you put hate there in the sense that we normally use it, you have a very pessimistic statement. But this is a willful decision. Here is a conscious decision that Kohelis is making on the basis of his investigation. Here are these good things, yes, but look, life is vanity. All of these things in life are temporary. Man, I'm an eternal creature. I cannot be satisfied with the temporary. I have to find my satisfaction in the eternal. You see what I'm saying? Yeah, that's pretty good if you understand. But that's a limitation. And it's the limitation that labor has on it that helps us to put that labor in the proper perspective. So we learn to follow that advice. Reject life as an end in itself. We do not, how can I say this? We do not live for life. We do not live for life, for the purpose of life, for just this temporary scene. We enjoy the present, but what's the secret? While enjoying the present, we are looking to eternity. We are looking to the future. We are looking to that which God has for us as eternal beings. So a limitation of our labor is that it is vanity. It's temporary. It causes grief and pain. Verse 23 of chapter 2. For all his days are sorrows, and his travail grief. Yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night. This also is vanity. There's grief, there's pain that can be associated with the performance of our labors. It's not the source of lasting security. It never can attain any permanent goals. Look at chapter 1, verses 5 and following. have here the theme that our labor, our activity cannot achieve any permanent goals. The sun also arises, and the sun goeth down hasteth to his place where he arose. Verses 6 and 7 give various illustrations from nature of this perpetual activity. The rivers go to the oceans, but yet the oceans never seem to be filled. It never accomplishes its purpose or its seeming purpose. And you have a constant cycle being expressed here. The rivers, the heavens rain, and the rivers collect the rain, and it goes to the ocean and evaporates and starts all. And you have this constant monotonous cycle that's taking place even in the realm of nature. And life itself has that same kind of cyclic, never-ending process. Verse 8, all things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun. There's no lasting, final contribution that our labor makes. You house wives, you make your beds, and you do the same thing the next morning and the next morning, and it's cyclic, and it's over, and it's over, and it's over again, and it never seems to stop. The dishes get dirty, and they don't stay clean, and here it goes over and over and over again. Well, recognize that. That's a part of life. Everything in life bears witness to that same cyclic pattern. Therefore, there's no permanent achievements that can be accomplished with labor. Another limitation in this same thought of not producing any lasting security is the fact that we're always going back and forth. There's, for every advance in life, there's a setback in life. There's times of prosperity, there's times of discouragement. In chapter 3, in those opening verses that we've addressed earlier, you see the contrast. There's something to balance off everything in life. Step forward, a step back. A time to be born, wonderful, but yeah, there's a time to die, and that takes care of that. A time to plant, a time to pluck up, a time to kill, a time to heal. You have all of these reversing activities taking place in life. And we have to realize that in our labor, in the experience in every way of our life, we are not always going to enjoy a smooth road. Everything is not always in life going to be easygoing, and God does not intend it that way. I call your attention to a verse that I have referred to on many occasions in various contexts from Ecclesiastes, and here we see it in part of the argument, chapter 7, verse 14. Wonderful verse. And if we can get the theology of this verse in our hearts as well as our heads, it'll make life a bit easier. It's not always easy to do. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. That's a command that's very easy to obey. It's not hard to obey that command. When everything goes our way, it's very easy to be joyful. There's one we can obey. But notice what it says. But in the day of adversity, consider. Prosperity, adversity, both are going to be part of life. Now consider this, that God also hath set the one over against the other. God is in control of the day of adversity, the same as He is in control of the day of prosperity. Get it straight. Some of the charismatic notions tell us that God is always wanting you to prosper, to be abundant. And it's always the devil that brings in the bad things into your life. And it's your lack of faith in the goodness of God that produces the times of adversity. You got to read your Bible. It's not true. Prosperity and adversity are both in the hand of God. And God uses prosperity and adversity to accomplish His purpose. And what's the purpose? We don't have to guess. It's given to us here. To the end. For the purpose that man should find nothing after him. Now, there's some question of interpretation in the last part of this verse. Some interpret this to mean that God is bringing man to utter desolation. That God is fickly dealing with man, giving him prosperity and adversity to the purpose that man might find nothing after himself. Man might be brought low. Maybe. But I don't think that's the idea. I would suggest that the last hymn, you capitalize the H there in the last hymn. Capitalize the H. God is setting prosperity against the day of adversity for the purpose that we might find nothing after God. That God uses the setbacks in life to remind us of our dependence upon Him. To remind us that everything in life is from the hand of God. To increase our dependence and our trust and our reliance upon Him. Yes.
Nothing lingering, and I'm glad you are. There seems to be a problem with pronouns in the Old Testament. What is the antecedent to the pronoun him? Is it man or is it God? How do you know? Is there a linguistic way of looking at, interpreting this verse? What is the by just asking what is the antecedent of the pronoun him and answering it that way?
Well, that's always a question that we ask, but it's not generally it's not always a grammatical answer to that question. If I have in a given verse words that are of different gender and number, it's very easy to designate. In Hebrew, we have gender and number. And a pronoun always agrees with its antecedent, with the noun that it refers to, in gender and number. So we have that fundamental thing that we can look for. But oftentimes, there may be in one verse two nouns that are possibly the antecedent, both of which are of the same gender and number, and therefore it has to be the context. This particular reference, unfortunately, cannot be solved by observing the grammar, for both God and man in Hebrew are in the same gender and number. So it's a matter here of context. It's a matter of context. So Hebrew is not the answer to all life's questions. Sometimes, in fact, it creates more than it answers. That's beside the point. So this is strictly really a matter of interpretation, and I think the interpretation is clear, just as clear in English as it is in the original text. But I think in view of the context, you go back to verse 13 and you see the emphasis on the work of God. Consider the work of God, for who can make that straight which He hath made crooked? Here's God's sovereignty and God's superiority and God's providence working itself out. Now, here are two aspects of that: the day of prosperity, the day of adversity. And I interpret this verse in the light of what I see to be the overall direction of the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is not giving us a picture of a God who is out to get man, who is out to destroy man. This is a book that is dealing principally to Bible believers, to Christians, to believers in the gospel who have a relationship with God. Now, God is not fostering the picture of Himself to His people that, hey, I'm out to get you. I'm your enemy. I'm going to stomp on you and smash you in the ground and everything else. That is not how God reveals Himself. But I dare say that there are many people, Christians out there today, who have that very view of God, who think that God is their enemy, who believe that God is out to get them, to smash them, that God is there with a bullwhip in hand to knock them down at their first evidence of disobedience. That is not God. That is not the God of the Bible. It's the God of man's imagination. But it's very easy for us, with the eye of sight, with sight, to look at the adversity that comes into our life and to interpret that as God's whip and scourge over us. That God is our enemy up to get us. But with the eye of faith, we look through the adversity to the God who controls every aspect of our life, realizing that always, all things are working together for the good of those that love God. That's always true. We can't always see it. And it becomes a matter of faith to look beyond the adversity to the hand of that God who is working all things out for our good and for His glory. It requires faith. And what is faith? It's that dependence. It's that reliance upon God. And is that not exactly what Kohelet is saying here? God is bringing these two things together for the purpose that we might find God, that we might learn again to trust Him, to rely upon Him. Let's face it, we know ourselves as God knows us, in the sense that when everything is going well, it's very easy to become complacent. It's very easy to forget God in the midst of prosperity. It's easy to do. Very easy to forget God in the midst of prosperity. You go back to Deuteronomy. As Moses is preaching his last sermon, he gets the people there, particularly in chapter 8 of Deuteronomy, and he warns them against this very thing. You've been in the wilderness. You've been in this time of constant trial and adversity and trouble. Everything has been going hard for you now for 40 years. And every one of you during this time of trial and tribulation have had constant daily reminders of God's protection and provision for you. What did they eat during those 40 years? Every day. And the manna from God. Every day God gave them food from heaven. Every Israelite had clothes that did not wear out for those 40 years. Even the kids had shoes for 40 years. I suppose that, for a parent, becomes one of the most attractive periods of biblical history. To have been in the wilderness to buy one pair of sneakers that would last for 40 years. What do you do? But every Israelite, you see, had that constant reminder during that time of difficulty of God's dealing with them. But what was going to happen? They were going to go in the land of Canaan, a land flowing with milk and honey, prosperity. And as soon as they got into the place of prosperity, the manna stopped. As soon as they got into the place of prosperity, all of a sudden, their feet began to hurt and they needed new sandals. But they had the means there to supply those needs. The ground was abundant. The pastures were rich. And they could supply now their own needs. God would give the rains. And Moses looked to that time and said, "Now you be careful. What's going to happen, you're going to get into that place of prosperity. And you're going to start trusting in what you can do. You're going to start relying upon your sheep and your goats and your agriculture, and you're going to forget God. Remember, remember, remember the wilderness." And so God established there the Feast of the Tabernacles. The Feast of Tabernacles. What was one of the main purposes of the Feast of Tabernacles? The Feast of Booths? To remind the people of the wilderness. When they were in prosperity. Remember the wilderness. Remember the adversity and how God supplied your needs. And even though you're now in prosperity, God is still in control. He gives the rain. He gives the abundance. He controls the climate. All of this is still from the hand of God, but now there are the secondary causes. And human nature, even that of believers, if we're not careful, will tend to forget God when everything is going well. So what does God do from His grace? Every so often, because God is gracious to us, He sends the adversity. He sends the adversity. And I'm sure each of us can testify that while we go through the adversity, it's not a pleasant thing. Not a pleasant thing. And I don't in any way minimize the degree and the intensity of the adversity that God will put us in. But no doubt we all can look back at our life in times where there were adversity and see now in retrospect that those days of adversity were often spiritually the most precious times in our life. We saw there and knew in a very intimate way our dependence and our reliance and our trust upon the Lord. But God knows the end from the beginning. All we see in time is what we see. It's a matter of faith to look beyond the adversity to the purpose of God and trust Him more and more. So this is one of my favorite verses in Ecclesiastes. God is working all to the end that we might find nothing after Him. Well, our time is gone for today. A few more things I want to say about labor, and then we'll try to finish this up as soon as we can these next couple of weeks. All right, that's all for today. Gene, would you close us in prayer today?